Thank God it's Free Range. You are listening to Free Range Radio Friday with your host, Michael Elves. Pour yourself a beverage and turn up the volume, because here on 101.5 UMFM, the weekend starts now.
UMFM, this is Thank God It's Free Range, the Friday edition of Free Range Radio. I'm Michael Elves, and that was Los Straitjackets with their Game of Thrones cover. That show is back Sunday night for its final season. Speaking of being back, Ticket Momster back in town after a little holiday. We're going to get into her picks in just a few moments here on the Go to the Gig segment, and we got lots of stuff to talk about, so we're going to get right into it. Keep it locked here on 101.5 UMFM.
It's Ticket Momster. So I've been out of the country on vacation for the past 2 weeks, and during that time, the Fleetwood Mac show was postponed due to Stevie Nicks' flu, and Jazz Winnipeg announced their lineup for this year's TD Winnipeg International Jazz Festival, which is one of my favorite summer festivals, and I can't wait to dig further into their lineup. One of my vacation weeks was spent at Disney World, and I've yet to figure out how to relax at Disney World with a 7-year-old, so I'm tired. We went non-stop, and I feel like I need a vacation from that vacation. However, a good time was had by all, a great time, really. And I don't want to stop that feeling. So here's a tune from Mary Poppins, the first one. sung by one of the most gorgeous soprano voices.
In every job that must be done, there is an element of fun. You find the fun, and snap! The job's a game. And every task you undertake becomes a piece of cake, a lark, a spree. It's very clear to see that a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. A robin feathering his nest has very little time to rest while gathering his bits of twine and twig. Though quite intent in his pursuit, he has a merry tune to toot. He knows a song will move the job along. For a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down, the medicine go down, medicine go down. Just a spoonful of sugar helps the medicine go down in a most delightful way. The nectar from the flowers to the comb never tire of ever buzzing to and fro, because they take a little nip from every flower that they sip, and hence they find their task is not a
incredible soprano Julie Andrews with A Spoonful of Sugar. I know she can't sing like that anymore, but I will never not enjoy that voice. Ah, it's so beautiful. Okay, let's move on to my concert recommendations for next week. This Sunday is Mama Cutsworth's family dance party at the Goodwill Social Club. Yes, the bar, and yes, I'm encouraging you to take your small children to a bar. Trust me. These dance parties are tons of fun. It's $5 at the door. Show up at 1 o'clock. This Wednesday, Alice in Chains are playing at the Burton Cummings Theater. Tickets at Ticketmaster.ca. And while I do enjoy Alice in Chains music, it was announced this past week that City in Color are opening for them. And suddenly I became super interested. I love City in Color. So let's skip the Alice in Chains song, sorry, and play one of my favorite City in Color tunes instead. It's not a popular song, and I don't know anyone else who likes it either. So all the more reason to play it, I guess. Here we go. This is off City in Color's latest album, If I Should Go Before You. This is Runaway. Listen for Matt Kelly's pedal steel in this one. So great. City and Color with Runaway, some lovely pedal steel work by Matt Kelly on that one. Next Friday, Michael Bublé is playing at Bell MTS Place, tickets at ticketmaster.ca. If you don't have tickets for that show, go see Begonia at the Goodwill Social Club, tickets at showpass.com. She's putting on a pop-up concert there. Surprise! If I could get out of my tickets for Michael Bublé, I'd be there instead. If you haven't heard Begonia, here she is with Hot Dog Stand. I double dog dare you not to cry. And that's it for this week. Check out my Facebook page at Ticket Momster. That's Ticket, M-O-M-S-T-E-R, for more show recommendations. And I'll talk to you again next week. Have a great week. Good night.
Clouds fall and nothing's new for me. I've seen it all, but not enough to truly see. My lipstick loud, my heels are proud. If you were here, you'd agree. I'm ready to fight. I'm ready for the night. I'm feeling all right. Chop through smoke with my two hands. I may have broke a couple bonds, but I've got plans. Then I always end up I drink too much. I end up flying. Makes me feel like everybody's problems are worse than mine. From Market Street to the hot dog stand, hold my hand. I'll let you hold my purse. It couldn't get much worse, but, and you won't get a thing from it, 'cause I only need a man. From Market Street to the hot dog stand. I find myself in this spot from time to time. I can't tell if it's dark or not, and I'm not blind. When everything gets to be so hazy, when I feel like being alone makes me feel so crazy. From Market Street to the hot dog stand, I'll let you hold my hand. I'll let you hold my purse. Yeah, you could be my nerves, and you won't get 'cause I only need a man. From Market Street to the hot dog stand. Oh, from Market Street to my front door, you better stop me, 'cause I can't take it anymore. And you look so pretty of the moon, but then again, I've never seen you in the afternoon. I'm scared of the light. It's just not our time. But tonight I'm just fine.
April is Minnesota Music Month here on The Current, and to celebrate, we're doing a very special edition of the Midwest Music Exchange, which we've done for several years with our friends up in Winnipeg, but this year we're adding Radio Milwaukee. So every night this week we've been featuring a band from each of the three communities, and we've put on two shows so far, up at the Goodwill in Winnipeg and Wednesday night at Ice House, and tonight at Company Brewing in Milwaukee. We'll be wrapping it up. You can find more details about the scenes of both the cities on the website right there under the Midwest Music Exchange. And I've been joined every night this week by Mr. Michael Elves, PD of UMFM up in Winnipeg, and thanks to him and Manitoba for Music for being our partners in this again. And I hear, Michael, that you've got a big artist out of Winnipeg that's going to represent for you tonight to wrap it up on this Friday evening.
Right, yeah. No, I'm excited to spotlight this artist. She's going to be big. Taylor Jansen, she just turned 20 years old. She was named one of the top 20 acts at South by Southwest earlier this year by Paste magazine. And nice. She actually just debuted the track that we're going to play on Paste at the end of March. She also got notice from Rolling Stone for her debut EP, Interpersonal, and it drew comparisons to Julia Jacklin and Phoebe Bridgers. And she's going to be one of the headlining acts at the Winnipeg Folk Festival in July up here in Winnipeg for folks looking to make the trip north. So Taylor Jansen, the EP's called Shouting Matches, the single's called Shouting Matches, and just remember the name Taylor Jansen.
Well, thanks, Michael Elves, PD of UMFM, for being our guest host this week throughout. And, of course, the Folk Festival, a great reason to visit Winnipeg. But start with Michael at UMFM if you want to get up there any time of year to sample the local music scene. So thanks once again, Michael.
My pleasure.
And we'll hear Taylor in just a second, right after the final Minnesota act, that is Gully Boys. Nadira on drums, Natalie on bass, and KT on guitar. They've been friends so long and so deeply that they call each other brothers, so Gully Boys was the name they picked when they put the band together. They started off recording at the famous Pachyderm Studios and put out a catchy pop album Not So Brave late last year. It buzzes, it's got soaring vocals, and it did really well on our top local 89 of the year. They were at number 20 with another song from this album, and their album was picked by our hosts in the top 10 albums released of the year. And this song is the crucial number 7. I always think, Michael, you have to have a good song at number 7 on your album, and this is it for Gully Boys, Neopet Graveyard. And then Taylor Jansen on the Midwest Music Exchange from The Current and UMFM in Winnipeg.
Thank you. hard and I can't make out a thing. So I burned all my bridges down just to have something to see. But you don't need to worry, darling, I don't need to escape from this ever-growing sadness that I can't help but create for myself. For myself. Well, if I knew what was good for me, I'd open up the blinds. I'd let the sun fill my room and I'd let it change my life. But you don't need to worry, darling, one day I'll be just fine. I'll stare up into the sun.
Well, playing the West End Cultural Center tomorrow night, J.D. McPherson bringing his new album, Undivided Heart and Soul, and he joins us from the road. Hello, J.D.
Hello, hello. How's everybody doing?
I'm doing well, and I understand, you know, you're a little road weary. How far into the tour are you?
Well, I kind of get, time gets blurry for me, but I mean, I guess we're a couple weeks in.
Right. Is there like a certain point at which, like, I hear about like marathon runners and they say, like, you know, go halfway and then like one step further and then, you know, you're on the, like, the back end of the marathon. Is there like a point like that for you on a tour where like it lets up a little, because,
well,
you know,
I would say, it just really kind of depends on the tour. If it's a lot of long drives, it can be a little more daunting than if it's just a bunch of short drives all together, like maybe on the east coast of the U.S.
Mm-hmm.
So it sort of is broken up. Well, you usually know what the halfway point is, and then there's also like certain shows you may look forward to because you have some friends in that town or things like that. So there are, every tour is different. It kind of breaks up where it really could, your halfway point might be literal or, you know, figurative in some kind of way.
Sure enough. So I want to talk about the new record, Undivided Heart and Soul, because this is kind of a change up for you. But most particularly because you relocated before this record, a move from Oklahoma to Nashville. And like, did you feel that there was going to be a sort of shift in your music as a result of that move? Or like, was that like an intentional thing? Like, I'm going to change because I'm going to go to, you know, Music City here? Or what was your kind of expectation?
I moved to Nashville. It was kind of like you can't say you moved to a new city accidentally, but my family, my oldest daughter was getting ready to head into middle school, and I was kind of like, well, we weren't crazy about that. So we were going to move houses anyway to get into a new district. And we were like, well, I had been going to Nashville a little bit to co-write with others, and it was something I found rewarding, and, you know, that's a good thing to do on the side if you're a touring musician, if you can get it. And so we just kind of like, well, let's just go to Nashville and put our house up for sale. And it sold almost immediately, and we weren't expecting that. So we had to move really quickly. And all of these things, you know, moving a family that's never moved out of a place to a new city and a big city comparatively,
mm-hmm.
Was a big change for everybody. So I'm sure that did have an effect on everyone. But being in the Nashville sort of music community was a really positive thing. Like, everyone was really welcoming, and I was able to meet a lot of new people. But really the change in sound happened just because the songs were coming that way. And, you know, I was sort of resisting it a little bit. I was like, well, who's going to record this song? You know, who's going to record this one? This isn't for me. This is for somebody else. And I was, you know, kind of going through some things, because at one point I remember the song On the Lips, my wife said, I said, oh, I got to find somebody to record this one. I really like it. She goes, well, it's very obviously autobiographical. Maybe you should do it. So getting in the studio, I mean, the whole record was really, really difficult to make. Like, I don't want to tell a sob story, but basically we found ourselves without a producer, without our studio, without a budget. We kind of burned through the first couple of steps, and we were able to land at RCA Studio B, the famed studio in Nashville, which is now just a museum. I don't think there'd been a record made there since the 70s, but that's like where all the Nashville Sound Country stuff had been made in the 50s and 60s. Elvis recorded there post-Army, Roy Orbison, all of the stuff that you know of Roy Orbison, the Crying, and Only the Lonely was recorded there. So it was a huge deal for a band like us, who's really, you know, cares about music history and is into it, to be there. But it was a weird situation where we were like loading in every day after the tours were over and recording all night and then tearing down, which anybody that's ever recorded knows that's a really tough thing to try to do. So I think maybe all that duress added a little bit of edge to it. And I'll tell you, one thing is, when we started recording there, it seemed like we wanted to kind of make an RCA Studio B sound, but the longer we were there, the louder and fuzzier the songs got. So maybe that room had a couple of phantoms it was trying to
exercise, let
loose in the world or something.
The loading in and loading out every day, and then basically kind of hitting a reset on the setup, like you said, that's not something you would want to do. If you're in the studio, you kind of want to have it set and then just kind of go in and out of the room. Did that like create sort of a like tabula rasa for you each day? Like, did you know, you're starting from scratch again. Is that kind of like a mental reset?
I think maybe so. I think it did. It, well, one thing it really developed was a sort of an economy of equipment choice.
Right.
Like the first couple of days we were loading in, you know, we had gathered together like 15 different amplifiers, and we had just racks and racks of guitars that we were bringing in. And by the end of the session, it was one amp, one guitar. This is the guitar I'm using. This is the amp I'm using. You know, we're stacking the drums up in the back closet somewhere, and that's what we're going to do. So it was kind of an efficient setup, I would say. But you didn't get the kind of spaghetti of cables and, like, you know, random teacups, you know, weighing around the studio like you do when you're making a record usually. Like, by the end of the first day, mics are really, it's very Spartan scene, and, like, the mics are kind of set up in a really, like, kind of nice sculptural way, and everything's nice and clean. But usually by the end of a session, it's just a complete disaster area. But we had that kind of clean Spartan setup every day. So I don't know. I kind of enjoyed that, but I didn't like to load in and load out at, like, 4 a.m.
Right. Does that kind of, like, spareness to the fact that, like, you weren't getting kind of cluttered and stuff affect your, like, mind space when you're singing or performing? Like, do you find, like, a stage or a place can impact your mental state when you're, you know, recording in it or performing on a stage? Like, have you found, like, when you've been on a stage that's super cramped, that you feel tight, or if you're, you know, relaxed in an atmosphere because it's just kind of homey? Like, does that have an impact?
We were just speaking about that last night in the band. We played a stage in Calgary that was sort of a small, like, it's more narrow, I suppose, and it was curved. So we set up a little differently than we normally would. And as opposed to, we played a stage in Vancouver that was massive, and like, we could just sprint, you know, back and forth doing David Lee Roth moves all night. And it was, so it's a totally different thing. And I think that does change things a little bit. Like, last night's show was great, but in a totally different way. Somehow we were listening to each other a little more. You know, you're closer together, so you're not maybe as loud as you might normally be. So yeah, it's just different. Every venue, there's a really great David Byrne book called How Music Works, where he goes into the idea of music being sort of influenced by environments. And that is an interesting thing to me. I noticed that as we, as a band, I guess as a career, starts to go forward, as we play maybe incrementally larger venues, I think the venue sizes start to influence songwriting in a way.
So you're writing, you know, with the projection
of space? Some of our acoustic instrument stuff. What's that?
You're writing with the projection of what a space the song will have to inhabit?
Yeah, I think so. I think, like, you know, when we were playing consistently small stages, and, you know, we're a lot of acoustic instruments, that doesn't translate as well to playing a big hall or something. So I think that kind of, especially for me, I tend to write, when I'm writing music and lyrics, I'm also thinking about production too. I can't help it. It's a part of the language to me a little bit. So I tend to think about, like, instrumentation and stuff like that. And I think that does influence bands in a certain way.
So you do hear full songs in your head when you're writing them?
No, I mean, I would say it's almost like a looking, I guess the best metaphor I could use would be like having a camera, looking through a camera lens that's just slightly out of focus. You know what I mean? It's there. You can kind of see the shapes and things, but then you'll bring it back. You'll bring it into sharp focus when you're making the thing.
Right. So then, you know, with something like Undivided Heart and Soul, how do you know, like, is it just like the same with, like, a picture and resolution, that it, like, snaps into focus? Like, how do you know that you've snapped into focus with a record?
Well, when you're writing the songs, I was actually feeling pretty anxious during the songwriting, because I was like, oh, this stuff is different. You know, this is a different animal than the other stuff people are sort of used to hearing. And I did have a lot of kind of fear and anxiety to writing that record. I was just like, well, these are the songs that are happening. And I just, like, I don't know, like, it took a couple of things to happen for me to kind of feel I should not ever write with someone else in mind. I should always try to write what's happening with me. And I should always kind of follow the rabbit a little bit, because people can tell, you know, people can tell when you're trying hard to do something different, or you're forcing yourself to stay the same. I think people can kind of hear that. So it's one of those things. For Heart and Soul in the studio, it was there was a lot of fear, and anxiety involved. But man, once you're in recording, that's my favorite place to be, is in the studio. And I love making sounds, and I love dialing sounds in. And once things are kind of going down, you sort of hear it, and you kind of know it, and you intuit where they need to go from there.
Right.
That's usually the way it works for me anyway. I like to kind of mix as we go instead of mix later. Let's make it sound the way it's going to sound now, and not have to tweak it too much later. That's kind of the way I like to do it.
Firm it up. Don't let it linger. Before I let you go, Diddy, I want to get you to pick a track off the record that we can play for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about the song, I'd love to hear that.
I would probably pick... I'm trying to pick between two. A good anecdote. Jeez-a-loo. Okay, you know what? Why not? Okay, here's this one. So this was the main single off the record, and the reason I'm picking it, it's called Lucky Penny. The reason I'm picking it is because it was completely out of left field for this band. It sounded nothing like anything before. I had the guitar riff for years, but it was just a clean, I would play it clean. It was like a little, almost just like a little blues shuffle that I would play, almost like an exercise. And I played it for a couple of producers that we'd worked with on previous albums that, you know, hey, what does it think about this for an idea of a song? And everybody's like, nah. And I was given this fuzz pedal by Way Huge Electronics and the people at Jim Dunlop, and they sent me this kind of 60s germanium fuzz pedal called a Javelina. And as soon as I plugged it in, I played that thing, and that there it was. Like, that's the thing. So what's interesting and specific about that song to RCA Studio B that would not have happened anywhere else is there's a sound on the track, which is a vibraphone. It's the kind of bell sound that descends on the lead up to the chorus. So that would never have been added to that song if we hadn't been in Studio B. That vibraphone was the original vibraphone that was in the studio, and that's the same vibraphone that you hear on Roy Orbison's Crying. So anytime you hear that kind of tremolo bell effect on Roy Orbison, that's the same instrument that ended up on Lucky Penny. So in a strange kind of way, being forced to be in a place that we hadn't planned, that had all these like incredible vibey instruments, like the Floyd Kramer piano was in there, and the echo chamber really sort of influenced and pulled that record into a place it might not have been.
Right on. Well, we'll give that one a listen. Tomorrow night at the West End. In the interim, safe travels, JD.
Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Thanks for your time.
Thanks for your time as well. Take care.
Another day in, another begins, another night sleeping on needles and pins. I keep rolling where the battle wind blows. I keep running, but the trouble follows. Ain't no telling where I'm gonna end up. This lucky penny's been nothing but bad luck. Another wrong turn on the way to the top.
nothing but bad luck. Bad luck.
While touring on the strength of their latest record, Heaven, Dilly Dally come to the Goodwill April 16th alongside Chastity. Katie Monks from the band joins me by phone. How are you doing, Katie?
Doing sweet. How are you?
I'm doing all right. So you've got this, I mean, the record came out in the fall, and so you've put a lot of miles into this record so far. I have to ask at this point, like, is there kind of do you get a little tired of the songs, or do you kind of have to do something new to the songs to kind of keep them fresh as a band? Like, what's performing night after night on the same record like?
I mean, I like to think that we write songs that, you know, are hard to get sick of.
Okay.
So I guess, I mean, like, when we go to write a record, we don't write 50 songs and put 10 of our favorites on the record or something. We very much just like only have those songs, and the writing process is so natural. I don't know. I feel like the whole thing is bigger than me, I guess, is what I'm trying to say. And each night I go on stage, the songs kind of sound and feel a little different.
So you're small batch songwriters?
Yeah, I mean, the songs that actually make it to the band are the ones that I don't get sick of playing and working on. So I work on the song for a long time before I bring it to the band, and they all write their part. So I feel like by the time it goes through that whole process, it's music that there is like some kind of addictive quality to it. That we're not sick of any of the songs we play live.
You mentioned bringing songs to the band. I'd read an interview you did with Noisy around the time the album dropped, where you talked about kind of band members dropping in on you, and it was kind of like a band delivery service. I'm curious about kind of like the dynamic of like when you're not when one person at a time, or like little parts of it are being sussed out individually rather than as a group. Does that change the shape of songs, like, because it's kind of you're looking at it in a microscope?
So, as I understand,
you had band members, not everyone all at once, but individuals came in and helped you work out some of these songs.
Oh, I see. Yes, I had something called band delivery.
Band delivery. Okay.
Yeah. Oh, that's funny. No, it was just like a handful of times Liz or Tony would come by. And yeah, I guess it was the stage of the writing process where I wasn't ready to start working on drums, for example, because whenever I bring a song to Ben, our drummer, he's like, okay, like, what's the structure? Like, he needs to know the structure. Whereas, because the way I write is really, like, kind of free form, I guess, I ended up with, like, 100 hours worth of new material and ideas, so, like, chord progressions, melodies, lyrics, and just kind of was trying to edit through it and kind of, like, organize it. So I'd have Liz or Tony kind of come by my apartment every once in a while and just, like, help kind of pull me out of this, like, kind of just, I felt like I was swimming in new material. Like, it was, like, too much, but in a good way.
So then in sifting through that stuff, like, are you pairing chord progressions and melodies with lyrics, or, like, are you trying to figure out what works best together, or, like, winnow things down? Well, what's your kind of editing process like in that circumstance?
Well, I just kind of start to label things and kind of go, all right, this is a song. You know, all of these ideas here, these are one song, you know? And then kind of just, like, distinguish, like, okay, there's a theme here, so what's the song called and whatever, and what's the verse and what's the chorus? And I think sometimes I'll be working on a song for so long, I'll have so many ideas for it, and I just have to pull someone in and ask a bandmate, you know, which is, does this sound like a bridge to you? or like, you know, like, this is my idea, but I don't know if the chorus starts at the beginning, then what does that mean for how can we make the second chorus different, or blah, blah, blah. So I don't know, yeah, it's just, I guess, organizing stuff into, like, a classic, more classic song structure.
Right. And then you said, you know, what's the song called? Does the song tell you what it's called? Like, or is it kind of the content is kind of descriptive to you?
Yeah, I don't stress over it. I don't lose sleep over it. You know, it's just called what it's called.
And then the album title, I'm curious about kind of, was that kind of, because I know there's been a lot of discussion and even some of the videos around kind of the rebirth of the band and you know, addressing this kind of topic. Was it like a mission statement or kind of something you were reaching for because of the angels cards that you had picked up, or like what, how did you land on heaven as like, this is what the record is?
I feel like it's kind of, I mean, I grew up with no religion in my house at all. And music has always been my form of, like, my main kind of way of being spiritual. And I think for this album, because the writing process was so intensely spiritual.
Sorry, you said it was so intensely and then it got cut off there. Sorry.
Oh, sorry. It was so intensely spiritual, like my process for writing my parts of this album.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I had to climb out of a depression, essentially, and, like, really look deep inside myself and find some kind of wisdom to offer everyone else. So I felt like I could stand up on stage and have anything good to say at all. So the reason why there's kind of like cliche, you know, spiritual imagery and words throughout the album, but then kind of with this weird, dark, gothic twist on all of them. The reason for that, it was just very much me, like, just kind of latching onto, like, the nearest, like, kind of spiritual word or, like, language that I could find, which obviously was just, like, words like heaven and angels.
Mm-hmm.
And so I was just, I guess I was just playing with all of those words and ideas because I'd never really thought of them before, and wanted to kind of piece together my own kind of DIY spirituality punk world with our music. So that's kind of where that all came from.
So if music is kind of your connection to the spiritual, then was the period in which the band was kind of up in the air, like kind of like your crisis of faith in some sense?
I mean, I don't know about like faith. I mean like faith in like the world.
I
don't know.
You know, if you're believing in music as a sort of spiritual thing and then having, you know, a real kind of challenge to that, your participation
exactly,
in music.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly, yeah. I mean, I don't know. Nothing ever like really challenges like how much I believe in music.
Mm-hmm.
Was it heartbreaking to see that like the music industry is was maybe not like the best place for Tony and the band to find, you know, to get sober a couple years ago, you know, and with whatever depression and anxiety like all of us in the band kind of struggle with, and most people do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the music industry can be a really high-pressure kind of place and very, very, very emotional because obviously everyone's putting their heart and soul into their work. So I think the music industry, yeah, definitely, like, I don't think I'm as romantic about it as I used to be.
Right.
Yeah.
Did you have any hesitancy about writing about mental illness or mental health in the fact that, you know, you're going to be having to perform these songs and sort of like address the topic at some point? Like, I don't know if there was any kind of inclination to keep those struggles to yourselves or if it was something that you did want to broach as a topic.
It was weird. It was really weird, actually, kind of putting together the biography for this album and then like being thrown into that noisy Vice piece where, like, I mean, what I love so much about Vice is that they are really real and kind of, like, editorial and very, like, brash, I guess. And that's actually why I love that outlet so much. But it was definitely, like, a big wake-up call of, like, oh, yeah, we have to talk about, like, all of this dark shit that we just went through. And a lot of it we've still avoided talking about. There were, like, some deaths in the family and friend group and things that have still, like, we have avoided going into too much painful or just, like, difficult detail there. Even talking about it now makes me really anxious, but yeah, it's definitely like was hard to talk about these things, but the most healing part was when Tony stepped forward and said, when we put out Sober Motel and Tony stepped forward, the bassist in the band, my best friend, and said, like, I want to talk about this. My struggle with addiction, and alcohol, and because he has come so far, and there is this whole stigma and shame around addiction and being an alcoholic, and the fact that, you know, he'd worked through all of that shame to be able to admit it to himself and get sober, etc. Which he's been sober now for like 2.5 years, I think.
Mm-hmm.
So awesome. Anyway, him coming forward and talking about that not only reached so many people who needed to hear that message, who have like come to our shows and told us that, but also it was just like a really healing process, I think, for him and for the band, because we all, in a way, obviously he went through it more than any of us, but when you're on the road, we're all kind of like this one living organism. So I think it was just really therapeutic for everybody, you know?
Right. Now, you said you've had folks come to talk to him after the show, or, you know, address that track. Have there been other, like, responses to any of the songs? Like, have things resonated in terms of touching on stuff around mental illness and you know?
Totally.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, this guy came up to me 2 days ago at the San Francisco show and was like, "Your album saved my little sister's life." And there's like countless stories, which I'm like, I mean, I remember all of them pretty clearly, like when people tell me that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Of like how our music helps them climb out of a depression hole that the album helped all of us do ourselves as well. So it's been insane, like, actually, like, to think of that. Because, you know, we're not here trying to make radio hits, and the fact that our music is, like, reaching the people who it's supposed to has been really beautiful.
And I have to imagine that's somewhat more rewarding than just hearing from someone saying, "Hey, I really liked song X or song Y," that, you know, this has, like, a deep emotional resonance for me.
Yeah, I mean, I can go to sleep at night knowing that we put out something we believed in, and if all of our songs on the record were about drinking alcohol, I'm sure it would have done better, you know? Well, maybe not, because we would have been, like, really disingenuous. But, yeah, I don't know, whatever. It's just whatever. We're just being ourselves.
Yeah. I saw that you're going to hit the road with Mitski.
Yeah, that's going to be fun.
How did that come
about?
I
haven't met her yet, but she's shouted us out a couple times on social media and stuff. So
that's pretty awesome. So before I let you go, Katie, I want to get you to pick a track off Heaven that we can play for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking it or an anecdote about the song, I'd love to hear that.
Cool. Well, I would love to land on a nice note and play the song Heaven, which is the last song on the record. And that song is about how sometimes when things get real dark around you or you go through painful events in your life, it can bring you closer to your loved ones. And definitely, I think in the band, we're all a lot closer now. And so I think, but anyway, it's actually a love song. So that's the song I think you should play.
Perfect. We'll give that one a listen. Dilly Dally at the Goodwill, April 16th with Chastity. Katie, thanks very much for taking some time, and safe travels.
Thanks so much. See ya.
Angel blood.
right. Well, in town touring on the strength of their brand new album, Salt, BC band Blessed come to town on April 13th. And joining me by phone from the road, Drew Reichman. How's it going, man?
Good. I hate to dispel.
You're not on the road yet?
But I'm actually at home for one more day.
Okay, because you guys played a couple dates already.
Yeah.
I guess kind of.
Release shows this weekend.
Okay. So I saw the tour dates and just assumed you were just kind of in the car, basically. But.
No, yeah.
Starting it out at home.
Yeah. Luckily, when we came home from Texas, we scheduled 2 weeks off to do some hometown release shows. And then. Tomorrow night, I'll be in Calgary, and that'll be the first day of, like, the 9 weeks we're about to embark on.
So how do you psych yourself up for that? What's kind of your preparation or, you know, like, rituals or, you know, how do you manage knowing you've got a 9-week road stretch coming up?
I mean, I guess the kind of funny answer is that you don't really psych yourself up for it. I mean, in total transparency, there's, like, I don't know what you would do to, get your mind in a place to say, like, I can't wait to spend 9 weeks with 5 people in a small cargo van driving for 10 hours a day. But, I mean, that's not to disparage that obviously we're very lucky and privileged to be able to do what we do. And there's, like, many ups to touring around the country. And especially on this round, like, we're seeing a couple shows for the first time ever have some pre-sale tickets being sold, and we're expecting, like, some better shows along the way. So, I mean, there are elements to it that are easy to look forward to, but at the same time, like, there's a balance to it, I think, where you have to kind of go into it being like, okay, it'll be okay in the end. But
got to psychologically steel yourself?
Take it through both, you take it through both lenses a bit.
Do you pack, like, books or download podcasts or, like, kind of have something to kind of handle those hours in the van?
Yeah, I mean, a lot of us enjoy reading, and podcasts are a huge one. You can't really rely too much on movies or anything like that that involves a laptop, because, you know, your laptop on a 12-hour drive is going to die within the first 4 hours if you're watching movies or something like that. But, I mean, we've also been pretty good at kind of, we've been doing this thing in the van where once a day we try and show each other something we've all been listening to and try and engage in that kind of way with each other. And it's also a good time to, like, kind of talk about how we thought the show went last night or how everyone's feeling. And we're trying to institute some mandates into, like, our touring that are times for, like, openness and discussion to kind of, like, make things a little easier as we go along and make sure that no one's holding anything in, or just trying to make, like, a more emotionally well-balanced tour.
Is that, a conscious effort to engage with each other on that level to like, help the band dynamics?
Yeah, most definitely. I think because we spend 100 shows a year on the road generally, you learn over time how to adapt and make things easier on yourself. But something that wasn't happening in those first two was how to make things easier on each other and how to engage and interact with each other in, like, a meaningful way or a way that could help each other or lift each other up when someone's feeling down but you're feeling good. So, I mean, there was definitely a conscious effort to be like, we need to figure out some ways to engage with each other in a positive way despite the situation, like, despite being in a van and despite some of the things that you would look at and be like, that sounds a little miserable. But I mean, you know, I mean, the highs are very high, right? You play a very good show with your friends, and we're touring with Tunic from Winnipeg for a little bit on this one.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, again, the highs are there. I don't want to sound totally disparaging, but it can be nice sometimes to be a little transparent and talk about the other side of it.
Yeah, it's interesting you mentioned that, because I was listening to Rick Rubin's podcast recently, and he was talking So he was talking about how the Red Hot Chili Peppers, like, about 2 or 3 songs into their set, they'll stop and, like, gather around the drum kit and chat for a bit. And people are like, are they, like, figuring out what they're going to play that night or something? And so he'd ask the band, and they're like, no, we, like, kind of check in with each other and, you know, shoot the shit and talk about our day. And in some ways kind of like regroup and entrench ourselves as a band and as friends first so that we can kind of then have the energy to do the show. And it sounds like that's kind of a key to them having been a band for so long with fairly little friction. And it sounds like you guys have already figured that out in some way.
I mean, to a certain extent, but it's going to be an ever-growing and long learning experience, I think. As long as the band grows, we'll always try and become better at managing that and managing our expectations. And I think a lot of people have this vision of a band that they like or this vision of an art collective that they like where it's four people who come together as the best of friends. And then if anything goes wrong, like the friendship is put forward first and foremost, and the band breaks up if they feel anything is compromised in that regard. But I think a lot of the time you watch bands as they go along, I think bands stick together longer than people think and let those friendships become sacrificed, especially as you start seeing success in some regard or however you want to define success. But even just to a small level, I think people will start sacrificing those personal relationships to keep the project alive and the art alive. But that being said, I think taking stock of where you are and what you're doing, and even if you do feel yourself starting to grow apart or if you feel yourself starting to grow stronger, which is obviously more positive outcome of it, like trying to work towards just making sure everyone is feeling okay and good with each other and safe and uplifted, like, especially at the, you know, this is a funny time to be talking to me, I guess, just because it's the day before a 9-week tour.
Right.
There's a lot of preparation and thought on the mind that we're doing right now. Like, we're getting all our border paperwork in order. We're getting all our, we had a weird experience at the border when we tried to cross down to Texas, where we do everything completely over the table. And then they denied us for not having some weird document for our merch. And we got denied going down to South by the first time. And we had to go to another border an hour later. And that border was like, what did they deny you for? Like, I've never heard of anybody getting denied for this. They, like, called that border and were like, what are you thinking right now? And it turned out the border was totally wrong, and we got through. But I think now, like, today is just kind of a funny day because it's, like, the two people in the band, one of them being me, who kind of sort out the logistics of making things happen, we're kind of, like, stressing out about, like, what do we need to do so that they literally have zero reason?
Right.
But then you realize no matter what you do,
they may come up with a reason.
They'll just deny you for anything.
So yeah.
It's kind of like, yeah, I don't know. And, you know, it's just one of those days where we're also trying to ship out the last of the pre-orders. It's a big day today.
How did it land on you to be one of the two that does the logistics?
I think those are roles that just naturally developed over time. I mean, there's facets of the band that are handled by everybody in a different regard. The band is completely democratic in the sense that everything is split equally, 100%, no matter what. If it's income or if it's an expense or what have you, everything is split equally within the band. And that's kind of a facet of, I think, from an outside perspective, there are ways to look at a band where some people think, like, oh, that person does the emailing, ergo they do more work, or that person does tour logistics, ergo they do more work. But, like, I think when you're in a band with other people, you need to look at everything in a lens of, like, how are people contributing that you aren't cognizant of, and how are people contributing in a way that isn't directly tied to their labor. Because I think if you look at everything through the lens of labor, that's an unhealthy way of viewing the dynamic you have in your band.
Mm.
So, I mean, for us, 20% between the five of us feels equal, even if someone on a perceptive level to the outside, maybe looks like they're doing less or something like that. We don't really look at it in that light because there's an emotional burden you take on in going on tour. You leave work by going on tour. Like, let's dispel the myth that, like, any of us are making income from this in any regard. It's still very much a passion and labor of love and something we're working hard at changing over time. But, you know, you have to take every factor into consideration with people, especially, like, the emotional burden of, like, you know, one of our members has been seeing someone for a long time. To leave your partner for 2.5 months at a time, who you've been with for 5 to 7 years.
Mm-hmm.
There's just that. There's ways that going on tour affects people that I think the burden is split equally despite people having different jobs within the band.
Right. You mentioned Texas. That was South by. You guys shared the stage with Then You'll Know Us by the Trail of Dead.
Yeah. And what an unreal show to be a part of. And I mean, it's owed to a Canadian label, actually. I mean, Dine Alone put that show together and were kind enough to have us on it, despite the fact that we're not tied to Dine Alone in any regard. They liked the record, and I was super ecstatic. That was a great bill. Like, even a band like, you know, Wintersleep, the whole bill was just unreal to be a part of, but definitely And You'll Know Us by the Trail of Dead. There was a point in my life where that band was, like, a pretty prominent fixture, and despite them not being there anymore for me, like, it didn't take away from the fact that, you know, 20-year-old me, that you couldn't have told 20-year-old me I'd be playing a show with And You'll Know It's by the Trail of Dead and had me believe you. So, I mean, I obviously owe a very large thank you to Dine Alone for having us on that despite being an independent band.
Yeah, it felt like, I mean, that's the kind of band that I feel like could have subtly influenced the music that you guys make, right? Like, that, not necessarily like that that's a touchstone band, but that laying a lot of foundation for, you know, post-punk and these kind of really sweeping tracks. You know, I mean, you guys have tracks on the record that clock in at nearly 8 minutes long, and that was not necessarily something that a lot of bands did other than in, like, prog rock back in the day. And
yeah, no doubt.
You know, and then And You'll Know Us by the Trail of Dead and Explosions in the Sky and a couple bands like that really were like, let's take rock and put it into this non wankery but lengthy, yeah, and sweeping and anthemic type stuff.
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think there is, like, in an overt way, and like you said, maybe not a touchstone, but, like, there is a point in my life where they were a big part of it. I don't know if anyone in the band other than myself was into it at some point, but I think what you're saying is true, like, culturally and what those bands took and how they interpreted it. Or, like, a band like Slint is another good example. Like, the kind of lens that they looked through creating quote-unquote rock music through is super interesting. And I think it kind of changed the landscape to a point where, I don't know, like, it's kind of funny, like, the rock music as a genre or as a tag for your band is kind of like a contentious thing in the band, I think, a lot of the time, because, like, by definition, I think we are rock music. And when someone like a coworker or someone like your partner's parents asks you what you do, you say, oh, I play in a rock band. It's, like, super easy and a nice way to keep the conversation going without trying to get hyper-specific to somebody who maybe has no interest in it.
Right.
You know what I mean? But, like, I do think you make a good point in that, like, those bands did pave this way to, like, reinterpret what people can do with three guitars and drums and bass.
Right. Now, with the record Salt, did you guys have, like, a kind of conscious idea of what the record would be as a whole heading into the studio, or, like, what you wanted to achieve with this record? Like, is it, you know, because sometimes it's just kind of a snapshot or, like, a, you know,
a bookend of a period of time for a band, and sometimes it's much more of like a statement or something like that. And I'm curious about, you know, kind of what kind of conscious thought was in the band dynamic leading into the record.
I mean, that's a really good question. To a certain extent, Blessed has just operated on this idea of like unhindered creativity, where we have a rule in our jam space where we say we have to try everything once. If somebody comes in with an idea and it's so ludicrous and no one else in the band thinks it's good, like before we even play a single note, we've enforced the idea that we have to take that person's idea, learn how to execute it, and not only execute it once, but we have to execute it well. So, I mean, it eats into this amount of time that I think is still super valuable. But, you know, it makes sure that we explore every facet that people have an interest in. And I think Salt kind of came together in this very natural way, where Blessed kind of has this problem, or that's the wrong word to use. I try and be careful of my semantics here. Mm. It's not a problem necessarily, but we do explore a lot. And usually going into a release, whatever amount of material we release, so with the first two EPs, we put out 4 songs. With this record, we put out 8 songs. Behind the scenes of it, there's sometimes up to 40 or 50 snapshots of ideas. Not full-fledged songs by any means. Usually we only finish the songs that we want to create, but there's so many snapshots. And as we started seeing the snapshots and as we started seeing the pieces of music we were creating, we eventually did start to hear a record. And then we put a limit on the songs. We said, okay, we're going to make an 8-song record because that feels appropriate. I think there's a lot of records that come out that are over inundated they're just like, they have a massive track list, or they're, you know, anything that's 15 to 16 songs long, if there aren't like intermission songs or what have you, it can sometimes feel like some tracks get left to the wayside. Mm. And I know we made a conscious decision to say like an 8-song record feels manageable to a listener. And especially we have to factor in like, are we expecting people to engage with an 8-minute song? And people, I don't think, would engage with an 8-minute song on a 15-song record. So as we kind of create pieces of the mosaic, so to speak, it starts that way, like just kind of this like buckshot of ideas and pieces, and then the vision kind of comes together once we're able to start looking at those pieces and seeing a vision. And we kind of sometimes put creative rules on ourselves to be like, okay, well, if we say this, then we'll fit it into that mold. But I mean, as a whole, the record isn't a concept record by any means. And I have used the word that Salt is a snapshot in time. But I do think that disregards the amount of thought and effort that we put into what we release. Mm-hmm. Because generally, when we put something out, we're very involved in the artwork. We're very involved in the track listing. Even the length of the record is something we always talk about, like, if we really love a song, but the record is 50 minutes, a 50-minute record is a lot to ask of people at this point. And I think as time goes on, bands and artists are much less held to the standard of releasing a record. So if there is a song you love, really releasing it as a digital single the year after isn't going to be a huge hindrance anymore as it would be when you had to press a 7-inch to get it heard.
Right.
So there's like so many facets just of the cultural landscape and how we want to operate and taking into account that we actually want people to listen to our records front to back that factor into the creation of it all. But I mean, yeah, I mean, at its core, it is not a concept record. It is kind of a snapshot in time.
Yeah, no, it sounds like you're saying, you know, you guys kind of set an idea of what, like, kind of the size of the canvas, but that doesn't dictate what the picture is that you're drawing within it.
Well, that's better than I have said it yet, so I really appreciate that.
Well, you can, if you get asked that question again, feel free to use that analogy.
Thank you so much.
My gift to you. Before I let you go, Drew, I want to get you to pick a track off of the record that we can play for listeners. And if you have a reason why you're picking that song in particular, we'd love to hear it.
Yeah, sure. I mean, if there's time on your show, I know it's one of the longer ones. But the closing track of the record, Caribou, I think would be my pick. And I think I'm picking it because there's more accessible songs on the record, like quote-unquote accessible. But Caribou was just like this wild thing where we really threw a lot of precaution to the wind. And we're like, you know, usually when we're writing songs, we're looking at the length of them and we're saying like, oh, maybe like we could trim something here. Like, this seems a little long. This seems a little winded. But with Caribou, we really just engaged with like, this is how it feels good to play in a room together. And it felt good to, the track felt right at that length. Everything came together really quickly. There was a lot less contention around the writing. It just felt very natural and everything fit together. And we played at the length we wanted and in a room playing it together. It just felt right. And then we wrote that and recorded the record over a year ago, and then we hadn't played the song live since then. And we just played it live for the first time this weekend, and I think it instantly became a couple of our favorites to play live. So I'm super stoked to introduce it into the set list going forward on this tour. And yeah, it was just it was a wild, like, it was such a different it's such a different song for us to write. So I don't know that it's like representative of the album, but at the same time, I don't know what song I would pick that would be representative of the whole record, because when you enforce a rule on your band that you can't limit your creativity or the songs you release, I think we were very fortunate to release a record that represented a lot of what we loved. Well, at the same time, the reaction to the record this weekend has been amazing, and have people still engage with it and like it, despite the fact that it has so many facets to it.
Well, we'll give that one a listen on air, but hopefully we'll see it on stage when you guys play The Handsome Daughter with Tunic on the 13th. Drew, thanks very much for taking some time, and safe travels on the road, man.
Hey, thank you so much. I really appreciate you taking the time. Everyone who's been interested in the record, everyone who pre-ordered it and bought it so far, and everyone who's already come to the shows, like, obviously interest in a work that you've created as an artist is, like, incredible. I just appreciate everyone taking the time. So thank you very much, and we'll see you in Winnipeg, hopefully.
Awesome. Take care, man.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.